it's a great pleasure for it to have met you again after many years.
Oh, yes, right.
And to have a chance to talk to you about some of your writing and life. You're in many ways one of the most reflexive, reflecting of anthropologists, so this is a particular opportunity to see what imprint the elephant has left behind now that it's moved on. I was wondering, when were you born? What year was it?
I was born in 1926 in San Francisco. My parents were divorced when I was before I was three, and I was sent off to live north of San Francisco in the countryside with a unrelated woman of about 60 or so at the time, I guess she was, a woman I call Nana. And it was in Marin County. Well, now Marin County now is a very fancy place, but at that time this was the depth of the Depression. It was a little place in the hills called Woodacre, of all places, and it had 200 or 300 people. And I lived a very isolated life. I went to a two-room schoolhouse. Never went anywhere, did much of anything until the war came, which was then that would have been 15 years or so, 16 years on. And then I joined as soon as I could. Actually, I graduated my school and at the age of 17, and went into the Navy, and then ended up in the Pacific. And when I came back, left California more or less permanent. I mean, I've been back and forth, but I left it as home. And so there's a kind of cleavage in my life that's rather striking to most people when they hear it. It's striking to me, actually. The first 17 years or so were sort of living an isolate rural life in the depths of the Depression. We were poor, but we had enough to eat and we were warm enough, so it wasn't really that bad. But it wasn't as bad as many people had, and there was a lot. But we just lived on, since then I've lived a very cosmopolitan life. I've always thought, you know, I lived in a very, very rural atmosphere. I mean, it was very, very countryside. But I was urban from the start. Now, I don't know that, you know, what people would say about that, but I feel that I always was. So once I got out and got east, that's where I felt I belonged, or at least where I wanted to be. And I didn't want to go back because of the complexities of my family. Not only my parents were divorced, everybody in the whole damn family was divorced. It was a mess, but anyway, so I left.
Right.
Not much happened, that's the thing. There was a period in which nothing really happened. It's a funny kind of life. It was a rural countryside life, and you know, and I did things and stuff, but nothing.
There was no teacher who...
Yeah, there were teachers who were always my salvation. I was, if I may say so, a smart kid, right? So, and this is a countryside where even the kids who were smart weren't smart. I mean, they weren't supposed to be, so they didn't become. You know, some of them had good brains, but they didn't. But I was an intellectual to start with. I was alone. I was isolated. I read an enormous amount. And two teachers, one in elementary school, who thought I was a cat's pajamas and really taught me to learn how to read things and do things and get involved, whom I still remember with great warmth. I haven't seen her. She's dead now, certainly, but I mean, it's been. And then later on, even more importantly, a high school teacher, whom I do mention, I think, in something I've written, a man named Lawrence Tardy, who had been a merchant seaman and was a leftist. This was a time in California, of course, where the left labor unions were. This was the time of Harry Bridges. My grandfather was a labor union printer. I mean, we were all connected with that kind of thing, indirectly. My father was not. He was a civil servant, but the others were. Anyway, Lawrence Tardy was not an ex-radical. He's a radical, but he was now teaching high school. And he had a tremendous influence on. In fact, it was he who, after I came back from, while I was in high school, I was the editor of the high school newspaper. I worked up to the editor of the high school newspaper, and he was the faculty advisor. And he also had a tremendous influence on my reading. I wanted to be a writer and a novelist. Very young, as soon as I knew there was such a thing, I think. I mean, I don't know. It's difficult. I never wanted to be a fireman or anything like that. I didn't have that kind of thing that some people have. I always wanted to write, and I always admired writers from very early. And I certainly by the time I got to high school, I wanted to be a writer. And he encouraged that, and I did write some. Later on, I edited a college literary magazine, and so on. But anyway, Tardy had a tremendous influence on me. And when I went, as I say, went to the Navy in headed toward Japan to invade it, but the bomb was dropped. We were just about to get there as we turned around and came back. I went to him and said, you know, what do I do now? I had never thought of going to college because we were poor. I mean, not poor, or at least not well off. In those days, everybody didn't go to college. And I hadn't thought that I would go. I expected to work on a telephone company or something, which is what everybody did, or something like that. And he said, well, why don't you... And I had the GI Bill. That was the big... You know what the GI Bill is, I guess, for non-American audience, once explained that there was this enormous socialist enterprise in the United States in which any ex-GI, ex-serviceman, had the time served plus a year, tuition, books, a living expense. I mean, it was just the and anywhere you wanted to go that you could get in. And I said, he said, well, you've got this. Why don't you take it? And I said, well, I don't know where to go to college. I didn't really want to go to Berkeley because I didn't want to stay in California. And he said, well, this is sort of, again, left-wing college, experimental college in Ohio called Antioch, where they have this work-study program. You work half-time, you study half-time, and it's a kind of, it was always a very radical place, with ex-radicals teaching there and so on, or not always ex, but anyway, they're there. And I said, okay, and so I applied, never applied anywhere else, didn't think of the notion that you could, you know, that you apply and not get in, but I did, and they went on. So he had that, in, he sent me there, and he formed my sort of sense of self as a literary figure, and as a and politically, he did too, socially. And so, yeah, he was an extraordinary man. So between my grammar school principal, elementary school principal, and my high school English teacher, and some other teachers in high school also had some influence on me. Now, he wasn't alone, but he was way, way ahead, the most influential.
Sounds as if your parents didn't have much influence on you.
No.
Except in a negative way.
Yeah, it was negative. I'm not just stumbling for words because I don't know quite how to put it. They had a non-influence. My father had to be sort of almost forced to pay for my upkeep. And they were rather neglectful. My mother tried sometimes, but I saw my mother maybe once a year. I saw my father maybe once every 2 years. Neither of them wanted to bother with me. I don't want to call them. Later on, my mother at least tried. I mean, she made an effort sometimes, but it wasn't very effective. My father just was a detached character and wasn't hostile. I mean, I ended up, so to speak, burying both of them because I had to go back when they died, and so on, which wasn't so long ago. They lived very long. But no, they were just absent. They shouldn't have been parents. I mean, they weren't hostile. Not at all. I mean, they... but they were certainly neglectful, and I was just sort of something that they wanted to send off to the countryside and forget that ever happened.
You were the only child.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, they got divorced. They had been married only a few years and had me and got divorced. I mean, that was their marriage. They both remarried. Mm-hmm. Both remarried well, actually, I must say. They didn't have any children in the second marriages, but I liked both my stepfather and my stepmother a good deal, actually. They were very nice people. Mm-hmm. But... and I had some relation to my grandfather, who was this, I say, union printer on the Embarcadero in San Francisco. But but that was about it. And essentially, family was something for me by the time I got back in the 40s to get far away from. Anyway, the whole family was like that. I mean, it was multiplied.
On the war service, did you learn Japanese, or...?
No, I didn't do that. What I did do was, oddly enough, it'll surprise you here, I was an electronic technician. Mm. It's odd, because I had wanted to... They had what we call smiling seas, which were classification officers. They had a C on, they were always smiling, so we called it. They decided where you went in the Navy. So after going to boot camp, I had to go through boot camp twice because I got scarlet fever in the middle, so it lasted. I was in Farragut, Idaho, in the depth of snow. I'd never seen snow. Anyway, I got through all that, finally. And they had this program whereby if you volunteered, you could be, because the Navy, for reasons we didn't know, needed to go into, supply the medical corpsmen for the Marine Corps, that you could do that, because it was a non-combatant role, you could volunteer for it. I did volunteer for it, and was about to go into it, in which case I would be dead. I mean, there's no good, I would have gone to Iwo Jima, I mean, as a hospital corpsman, which is not the greatest idea in the world. Anyway, so I did that, and but then alas, they gave me they gave IQ tests, and I scored very high on the IQ test. And I went back to see the smiling sea, and he said, "You're not going to be a middle corpsman. You're going to be an electronic technician," because they had very, you know, they needed people. So I had it was the longest and most technical training for it under for non. Oh, I was just an ordinary seaman. Letter was a petty officer, and that's all. And so I went for 3 months to Chicago, a month someplace, then 3 months to Chicago, and then three or four months to Gulfport, Mississippi, and 7 months at Treasure Island in San Francisco. And I wasn't a radar operator, I was a radar repairman. And then I was, so that's, I became a technician, a petty officer, third class or second eventually. And I served on a heavy cruiser, a brand new heavy cruiser called the St. Paul, sister ship of the Indianapolis, which was famously sunk while we were at sea, so it was nervous-making. And we were sailing, as I say, toward Japan. I don't know whether we were going to... I thought at that time that we were headed toward Tokyo Bay, but apparently we were not. We were headed toward the south. The invasion was to come from the south. In any case, one day there's this announcement on the loudspeakers that a mystery weapon or something that, you know, the ultimate... They didn't say it was an A-bomb at those days, but some vital bomb had been dropped. And then shortly followed by the notion that this is the first we'd heard of anything like this, that the Trojan War will not take place. I mean, we weren't going to go in there. And so we sailed around a bit and then turned around and went home. And then all the people who were not regulars, Navy people, were discharged. I mean, so I got off and went back to San Francisco and spent about, 4 or 5 months wandering around. Also, at the government's expense, they had to also give you $50 a week for 42 weeks until you sort of readjusted yourself to civilian existence. And I wrote then. I spent a good deal of time. I lived in San Francisco in an apartment and wrote short stories and started a novel and various things. And then Tardy said, well, you know, go to, that's it.
When you went to Ohio University, were there any teachers there, again, who...
Oh, well, there was a tremendously shaping teacher. I've dedicated books to them and so on. I've even written about one of them, a man named George Geiger, who was John Dewey's last graduate student. He was also the backup to Lou Gehrig on the Columbia baseball team, which he never played. But he was an extraordinary man. He taught philosophy. I majored first in literature and then shifted to philosophy, mainly because in philosophy you could do almost anything you wanted. But I did both. And there were a number of figures who were important, but Geiger was absolutely shaping in my life. He's the man who made me into a kind of intellectual rather than an esthete. He's sort of known. He's not famous by any means, and he never will be, but he was more than just an ordinary philosopher. People didn't know of him, and he wrote stuff. Anyway, and it was he who finally, after 4 years working with him and doing things, who said I should go and be an anthropologist. And that was, again, I didn't know what to do with it. I had majored as an undergraduate in philosophy and literature, written papers on Emily Dickinson, on Hawthorne, on George Herbert Mead, on Spinoza, and so on, but not exactly a great current direction of there. I was very much interested then in New Criticism and things of that sort. I edited a literary magazine, you know, same old story. And I wrote. And I didn't know what to do. By then I was married to Hilly. I met her there and married her there. And she was an English major, and she didn't know what to do with either. I mean, neither one of us knew what to do. And I was out of the GI Bill, and Geiger had this American Council Learns this. I've had a lucky life, as you'll see. I mean, it's just everything turns up roses for me somehow. Anyway, he had this very lush grant that the American Council of Learned Societies, which is a covering organization in the United States, still goes on, still does very good work, had this grant program where in each small college, maybe not only small ones, but small ones were the ones where it really counted. As Antioch was, Antioch only were about 1,000 students, and half of them weren't there half the time, so it was very small, in a very small little Ohio town. Again, rural, but the place is very urban. It's all full of urban type. Anyway, in each small college, they took one professor and said, "You give this to anybody you want." So Gardner gave it to me. And I didn't know what to do with it. He says, why don't you try anthropology? And so I had never studied it, read it, or heard about it. Well, I had read Benedict, I think, maybe. I'm not even sure, but I think I did. But I certainly didn't know much about anthropology or have any particular interest in it. And but the reason he said that was because he had been in contact with Clark Kluckhohn. Well, how that happened, I don't know. Met him somewhere, I guess. And they were just starting the social relations department at Harvard. Kluckhohn, Parsons, Tucker Parsons, Sam Stauffer, Harry Murray, Gordon Allport, that lot, right? That famous enterprise. And he said, why don't you think about going there? And I said, well, what the hell? So I went out and tried to find out what anthropology was a bit. And then I had a friend, whom I knew at Antioch, who was working for Margaret Mead. Margaret was up in that tower, that famous tower in the American Museum of Natural History, which she, and she had, there really was a harem there, young women working for her. And they were all very loyal to her. She said, well, I'd get you an interview with Margaret Mead. And of course, by that, Hilly and I were both involved in this. And there was enough on this grant to finance both of us, which is extraordinary for graduate school. So even at that time, now it would be out of the question. But anyway, those were leisure times right after the war. So we went off to see Margaret, and she didn't know who we were from Adam. And she spent 2 or 3 hours talking to us, showing us her field notes. Field notes of Bali, actually, though they were very strange field notes. They were totally behavioristic. You know, Gusti stands up for 2 minutes, walks 30 feet left, sits down for a minute and a half, walk. They were just incredible, pages and pages of this sort of stuff that she had done with Gregory, I guess partly to go along with the camera stuff. But she was very enthusiastic, and she said, great, become anthropologists. So we did. And we said, then went, of course, to Harvard. We applied to Harvard, we both applied. There were only 6 people allowed in this year in the anthropology section, and Hilly and I both got in, and the rest is, I don't know, history or something.
Just as we pass people by, we may not come back to them.
Oh, sure.
It's nice to, there's any more to be said about them as we go past. So the first major anthropological figure we've met is Margaret Mead. They're, as you know, quite strong.
Well, they always were, yeah.
Your impression, certainly at the beginning, was positive. Did it continue positive?
Oh, yeah. She was, to me, I can see why people get furious at her. She made people furious. And did that without motivation, not without malice. But she was always extremely kind to me. And always very nice to me. And to both of us. The thing about Margaret is that she didn't have trouble with younger people. She was very good with younger people. But she had trouble with peers, and superiors. I don't think she thought there were any superiors, but peers she had trouble with. But she was very good with younger people. I won't make a total generalization, but I know a number of younger people who were younger when she was not younger, when she was already established, who, and the people who worked with her and so on, those women. Later on, and we stayed friends with her. I didn't see her often, and I didn't study with her. I don't consider myself a follower particularly. I'm not a non-follower, but I just didn't really study with her that much. Later on, Hilly and I were in, and she sort of referred to us as her friends of hers, younger friends of hers, among other people. We were in Bali. This was in 1957. That's far along, right? I'm already real anthropologist. I've been out there for a year, living in this little town. And there was this cremation, these huge celebrations that the Balinese have to bury the dead, just thousands of people and so on. But it wasn't in the town. It was down at the coast in a very remote area. And then there was no road. You had to walk in. And we had been down there for about a week. And it's dust and heat and thousands of people, and they have this crazy laughing going on. It's a really discombobulating situation. So Hilly is up at the palace where they cut a hole in the wall to take the body out, with that end of things. Then they carry it for about a half a mile down to the burning ground. I'm at the burning ground, so we're trying to cover this thing, like a couple of reporters. I do think anthropologists are rather like covering news stories anyway, but this is what this was. So I'm standing there, and I've been out there for 4 or 5 days without getting much sleep, and really in the heat and the dust. All of a sudden, the the dust sort of parts, and there, standing leaning on her famous crotchety stick, is Margaret. And I looked at her, and the first thing I say to myself is she real? If you're going to go crazy in the field, this is how an anthropologist is going to go crazy in the field. So I rush up back to, not to Margaret, but back up to Hilly and said, you're not going to believe this. I got to need a reality check. Margaret seems to be standing down there. So we went down and saw her. She was on one of her great trips, going to India, I think, and just had stopped in Bollywood, why not? Found out where we had been, went to our little town, found that we weren't there, but we were way out in this remote place, hired a car, walked in on her notoriously terrible legs. She had these ankles, you know, she was carried in out of, she talks about being carried in out like a pig out of New Guinea. But she was still, couldn't, and she walked on the stick. She walked in and she said, I know anthropology, and then we went up to her. Indeed was she, and we were sane, and she was palpable. And she said, I know anthropologists don't like other anthropologists and treat them on that field site, and I'm not trying to do that. I came here because I was passing through, and partly I want to see you, but also I have a friend of old standing, rather well-known, locally well-known, not locally, anywhere, whether it's a Japanese art salesman, a museum keeper, what do you call him, a gallery, named Jimmy Pandy, whom I had not met. And she said, I'd like you to come to dinner in a couple of days and meet this man, and it would be good for you to meet him. And indeed it would, we were there. And so that was it, that's the story. And then 2 days later we did, and on a beautiful beach at Sonora with Margaret and Pandy. So the answer to your question, she was always extremely kind to me, so I'm never going to say a negative word about her. I can understand why she drives some people crazy. That is, she could be difficult, all right, but she was never difficult with me. She was always very nice to me, and I remember her with great warmth.
Apart from the difficulty, in a recent interview, I heard a lot about the Freeman controversy. And I don't know whether, as well as the difficulty, she was alleged to have manipulated her data and made up quite a bit.
Well, I don't know. I have no way to know that. I have an anecdote about that, too. I went to Australia just 10 years ago or so to the Humanities Center for a summer. I give a general talk, and some guy stands up in the audience and starts asking me questions about why American anthropologists... Our talk was not on American anthropology. It was on, I can't remember what it was on, but the question had nothing to do with the subject matter of the talk. Well, it was Derek, and he kept asking his questions, and he kept, while I was there, he sort of kept pursuing me, trying to get me to say something negative about Margaret, or about American anthropology, and why we're all cultural relativists, and I just, my reply was, no, we're not all cultural, I didn't know what else to say. And I don't know if you knew Derek, but he was in and out of phase. I mean, he wasn't always off his head, he was sometimes off his head. I mean, I think he just was, everybody says he was. And as far as I can see, didn't know him well enough that I could make a diagnosis of what was wrong with him, but he did behave rather oddly. There are millions of stories you've heard. But as for manipulating the data, no, I think, I don't know whether she did or didn't. I thought that it was, I guess my loyalty to Margaret came out in the fact that I felt it was rather cowardly of him to wait till she died. That if you're going to take on Margaret, you ought to take her on. And he could have done that. I really do not believe that he could not have done it before she died. And then he would have been in for a struggle, and it would have been a fair fight. What the answer to the question is, certainly Coming of Age in Samoa is not a great book. But she's 26, it's early, it's 1926, she's 26, it's the beginning of things. So I tend to be a little bit more, a little bit less censorious. And some people I know in Samoa say it's not all wrong and so on. But that it's light and superficial, and she may have been, that I don't really know. And I have I don't have any inside story on that. I never talked to Margaret about it. Well, I never talked to her about Freeman, because Freeman didn't appear on the scene until she was dead. He then, he kept writing to me. The other thing, he was a strange man. So I never, I was in Australia, he kept sending me postcards with funny things on them, not odd statements on them. I never responded because I didn't want to get involved with this man. I never want to be part of somebody else's delusional system. I just figured, I'm not involved in this. I didn't work in Samoa, and I like Margaret personally, and I never did. And even when he did this, even from a distance, I get letters from him and so on, trying to get me involved and so on, why it was we were all conspiring to do something to him. And I wasn't conspiring at all, I wasn't doing anything. But on the issue itself, there are people better placed to decide what it was. I don't think Community of Small is a great book, but for a 26-year-old woman in 1926, it's not a bad book. It's a rather interesting, but maybe not a good anthropology book.
Coming back to Harvard, another figure there, one of the earliest books I ever read in anthropology was Clive Crookhorn's Mirror of the Man.
And yes.
Another witchcraft.
Mm.
From a recent interview I've done, he appears to be quite an eccentric character. Florence was eccentric too.
Yes.
Is there any sort of anecdotes or pen portraits or
impressions? Well, my relationships with him are really very complicated. He was a tortured man. I think that's something that people really don't know, and I don't want to. I don't know enough. He really was. He was, yes, difficult. I got caught between him and Talcott Parsons in a kind of crossfire, in which he publicly lambasted me, and it was very, as I only was a graduate student. So one of these were graduate students get caught between two professors, and it was quite. On the other hand, every time it push came to shove, Clive supported me. I mean, he's the reason I got the job at Berkeley. He's the reason I went to Indonesia and so on. So I have no real resentments. My relationships to him, I remember with a certain amount of agony. I mean, I really didn't. But he was tortured. I don't want to get. I have views about that, but I don't. That's not the sort of thing.
East European. It's a strange name.
No, he wasn't. Well, I don't know. He's very American. I mean, the Cluckone is not his own name. That's the other thing. He was adopted. He grew up in Iowa. His parents, I guess, died. He was adopted by the Cluckones. He was sick all his life. He had heart trouble from very early on. Was sent to the Southwest. That's where he got to become a Navajo specialist. Because I just want to be careful here, but he was a conflicted, deeply conflicted man. He was a wild Cold Warrior, and he ran the Russian Research Center. His son, as you may have known, had got in trouble for he shot a woman out of a window, supposedly accidentally, but who knows? Anyway, that. So their story, and Florence was also she had an odd disease of some sort too. Florence was my wife's thesis director. She got along with Orion. And I had no trouble with Florence particularly, but they drank heavily. I mean, I don't want to get too personal because it's not right to do that. But I think it's fair enough to say that they were not a happy crew. And on the other hand, it must be said that Clyde really supported me. He really did think I was going to do some good work, and he was hard to deal with personally, very, very hard to deal with. He played favorites shamelessly. I mean, in open way, played people off against each other. I mean, there's nothing new about that. You've heard that. I mean, I won't say who would, but but he was not a simple man. But I feel, despite what I just seem to be saying, I feel gratitude toward him. Yes, I feel warmly toward him, even though it was painful. There's been occasions where it was just. Just awful.
What about the other magnet in the other direction, Talcott Parsons?
Well, Talcott's all the other direction. Talcott was a bunny. I mean, people have usually overemphasized Talcott's influence on me, which I can't do. When toward the end of his life, Talcott was attacked from all sides, and I personally took a resolution that I'm not going to do that because he had been very good to me also. Though I myself never was, never really followed his line of thought and so on. But Togo was a very benevolent character. He's a very nice man, very strange, a little bit. I don't mean this as a clinical one, but schizzy-ish. He was a little removed, and he didn't quite know what was going on in Togo's big dome and so on. But and he had these elaborate schemes and so on. And I taught a course with him once, enjoyed it, and he was very, very good to me. And so I've always taken resolution that I wasn't going to join in this. Even though I think my work is often over-assimilated to that, but that's another long story. We can talk about that later if you want. But Talcott personally was benevolent, and I think one thing to say about one should remember about Talcott is the range of really good students he produced: David Schneider, Bob Bella, one I mean, I guess, but other people, you don't know, maybe it's Joe Berger. Okay, he had an enormous range of from infrared to ultraviolet, positives, all kind. Rene Fox, who's probably the main medical sociologist, a number of major figures now. So the image of him as some sort of a intellectual tyrant is all wrong. I mean, it's true, you couldn't budge him about it. The thing about talking is he had these things, enormous schemes. So whenever you tried to disagree with him, he would find a slot for you, and you would say, I would say, Tucker, no, we're in disagreement. No, I know it fits over here. I mean, you're under the I's and the R's, and never could get to Tucker that, no, on Tucker, on this, you and I are not of one mind. But he felt he could absorb he had a Hegelian mind. It was all going to be interpreted into the system. So you felt like you were floundering around in a sea of stuff. But he was a warm man and a very intelligent man, and I learned an enormous amount from him. The thing is, you don't learn from talking by learning the system. You learn from going, someday somebody will do an editing job on Parsons and take out the parts that are really valuable, because some of the stuff that's now supposed to be very avant-garde, about power, about status, he had years ago. It's there, but it's buried under 16, pages of something else. So, and as I say, he and more on, I think, Clyde's side, but though I don't really know the inside stories of this, had a kind of, after a while, there was a great tension. And I got caught between it because I was working a little bit with Talker, though I was mainly under Clyde. And that led to me getting sort of fired up from both sides. Well, though Talker was never, he never bought it.
He was very influenced, obviously, in many ways. He was the translator and publicizer of Max Weber.
Well, that is where he did have influence on him.
You acknowledge that's very right. Large influence of Weber.
And that's right, and it's also through him. I had never heard of Weber till I met Talkett.
Mm. Was Weber, would you say he is the classical figure who's influenced you most in anthropology, classical sociology?
Oh, so far and away, yes, still does. Yes, very much so. And, there's always this sort of New Testament, Old Testament view of Weber. I mean, there's Parsons, sort of the New Testament reader, and I got it, the New Testament version, that's true. But then later on also tried to read Weber directly in German and so on, which I couldn't originally, but I can now and read it. But Weber, yes, I still consider myself fundamentally a Weberian, yes, very much so.
Anyone else? I mean, Ricoeur you talked about.
There's an enormous number of people who've had influence on me. Money, Ricoeur, yes, all kinds of people who are not known. Kenneth Burke, who's a new critic, various kinds of philosophers, and Wittgenstein, enormously. I mean, that's a long story, but that is not self-discovered, but it's self, I didn't get it for any teacher directly.
Marx at all?
Not so much. I guess if you get Sarah Weber, you get to be a little bit skeptical of Marx. So, no, I've always been sort of skeptical of Marx and critical. Not really, no. I've read Marx and it has some influence, but on that line, I'm more Weber. And then the other figure, of course, is Durkheim, whom I've always had a arm's length relationship to. I admire him in some ways, but I really don't like it in some other ways. So, because again, with Tonkin, he was going to bring all these together, Marx and Durkheim and Pareto and Weber, all one big happy family, all with parsnip names. And again, he was a great, he was a very optimistic, Tonkin was a very optimistic character, and he had this sort of, and I didn't have that. I tend to be a fox, not a hedgehog, very much of a fox, and he was the ultimate hedgehog. I'm a tremendous, Isaiah Berlin had influence on me too. Isaiah who was responsible for me coming to Oxford that year and so on. There's an enormous number of people who've had influence, I mean intellectual figures of influence. But Weber is certainly it, and I think if you go the Weber way rather than either the Marx or Durkheim way, it's a natural way for a fox to go. I am radically a fox. I'm not a...
What about the earlier great tradition of American anthropology? Boaz, Linton, Lowry, these people, did any of them?
Well, I knew many of them, but No, Benedict had a big influence on me. I think I liked, because she brought an aesthetic approach to anthropology, which I...
Did you know Robert Lowy?
Yeah, I knew Robert Lowy. In fact, he was partly, I think, responsible for me for coming to Berkeley. I had met him when he came to talk. I didn't know him that well, but I met him when he came to talk at Harvard, and I was head of the student speakers thing, and I had him for a day and so on. And he was one who brought me to Berkeley, and before I went there, I went to the field in between and so on, and I saw him, and then when I got back, he was dead, alas. But yeah, I did know Robert Lowy.
I have a huge respect for him. I like his work enormously. Was he a nice man as well? Or?
Yeah, mine's the other way around. His work has not had much impact on me. The crow bores me, but that's just me. But I mean, but as a man, he was, yes. Again, I don't want to claim I knew him that well, but he was a very fine person. Kober I knew because when I went to Harvard, though I didn't meet him then, Kober and Klockan were doing that culture book, and I was a research assistant on it. I mean, I have a comment. And then later when I was at Berkeley, Kober was living, he was then retired, in fact, not too long from death, living up in the hills. And when I left, he called me up, and we had a long discussion about why I was leaving Berkeley after only a year going to 2 years, but really only 1 year there, to go to Chicago. And he was very nice, very well. But that's all I know of him. I mean, the relationship was formal, but pleasant. I mean, certainly he was, he wanted me to stay, but he did. He said, you know, I can understand why you might want to go. So I met Linton once or twice when he talked at Harvard. Clyde knew all these people, so we got to meet them all one way or another. But I can't say I knew Linton. I admired, of course, Sapir enormously, who was influential but never met him. Sapir has had a big influence earlier on. And that's through Klein. Sapir and Benedict and so on, that whole notion of mean is important. Whatever the shortcomings of some of the work, is still, you know, that. And Boas, of course, was dead before I came into the field, so I didn't have any inclination to Boas. But and I guess when I first came in, there was a feeling in the air, which was quite wrong, that Boas was, you know, well, that he was all about fish recipes, and so, you know, I mean, that he was the ultimate data gatherer, which isn't correct, actually. He was a much deeper thinker than that, but it took a while, and George Stocking and a few other people before we understood that. So I think I shared the cliché, not out of reading him much. I had read Primitive Man and Art, whatever it's called, and some others. But I had the general, yes, that he was about fish hooks and so on, and my interest in fish hooks was limited. Oh, sorry.
Returning to your PhD work, you enrolled, and how was it that you came to start your work in Indonesia?
Well, everything, by the time this is over, you're going to feel that my life is a continual chance of lucky breaks, but it's true. Hilly and I were studying at Harvard and working very hard for 2 years at Harvard. You worked extremely hard. I didn't do anything but study. And we were thinking vaguely, if you work was a destiny. It was going to happen. That was those days. It was a rite de passage. There was no question. And had to be out of the United States, another language. I mean, there was no. That's no longer the case, alas, in my view. But whatever I suppose. But anyway. I didn't know what I was. I thought, well, vaguely, I might go to Brazil, but that was just, you know, when it's there. So I'm walking across the Harvard Yard one day, and Doug Oliver, anthropologist, teaching at Peabody, comes up to me and says, well, we have this group project that's going to Java for 2 years, or 3 years, whatever it was, and we need somebody to study kinship and somebody to study religion. Would you and your wife be willing to do this? And I said, essentially, there's not the quotation, but I said, yes, where's Indonesia? You know, I mean, I had never thought of it, heard of it. It was extremely well-financed. Those were the days when things were well-financed. Ford Foundation was financing it. And we had, so I joined the group. There were 8 of us, I think, to start. Only about 5 may have managed to make it the field or some of 4 or 5. 8 or 9 to start. And we had language training every weekend, for the whole weekend, oral with this Diane, who was then the leading Malayo-Polynesian linguist, and then later on Rufus Hendon, who is now the leading Malayo-Polynesian linguist. So I said if we studied that language for a year, then went off to Java. But it was just you know, the finger of God. I mean, it had no... Now, again, it was Clyde's doing. I mean, Clyde had organized this, and he had said, Oliver, go get those kids. I mean, so that's why, again, I am very positive about Clyde, even though my personal relationships with him were not the happy ones. But he was very good to me. And that's how it happened.
What about that famous moment as you step onto the beach in, as it were, the Trobriands, and your first impressions as you arrive in Venetia? Can you remember that?
I remember that very vividly because I went to Holland for 2 or 3 months before I went to learn Dutch, to improve my Dutch reading ability and to learn to speak it a bit, but mainly to read it, and to meet some Dutch scholars, half of whom would talk to me and half of whom wouldn't, because that was the time when they thought America was stealing their empire. But anyway, never mind that. And some of them were very, very kind to me. So anyway, I lived in Leiden for quite a while, 3 or 4 months. Then got on a ship with all of his gunners. The rest came by later. Hilly, too, was in Leiden with me. We went on a ship, the Willem Raus, which took a month to get to Indonesia. The day before we arrived, the first coup d'etat rebellion against Sukarno government broke out, and it was a narrow run thing. It's called October 17th or 17th, I think that's right. And so when we arrived, there were tanks in the streets, and we had some friends, we had already been Indonesian friends, who were socialists, a member of Syariah Socialist Party. I know this is ancient history. For Indonesians know this history, but nobody else will. But anyway, Syariah was one of the first prime ministers, was a UN resident. And I didn't know him particularly, but I did know Sujat Moko, who was his right-hand man, a younger guy. So these socialists took us, especially Hilly and I, and put us in a sort of safe house of socialists. It wasn't clear whether the socialists were all going to go to jail, because they were the wrong side of this rebellion. It was very tense for 3 or 4 days. So I entered it, you know, at the first, right in the middle of a coup d'etat, or attempted one. It was eventually, Sukarno finally gave one of his famous performances in front of the parliament, gave a speech and talked the people out of their, essentially talked them out of the coup d'etat. And the socialists escaped without much damage, even though they were, still was early on days. Later on, they had more a harder time. So we came out of hiding. We didn't know for 3 or 3 days we were going to be arrested, whether we were going to be shot, or whether we were going to be thrown out of the country. And we didn't really know what was going on because we couldn't leave the house, essentially. And there were millions of rumors and a lot of socialist conspirators coming back. It was in the house of a man named Sam Udin, who is now forgotten, but who was a very important politician at that time, socialist politician. So yeah, I do remember putting my feet on the beach and then it then cleared up and we then went to live downtown and things were...
There was a certain amount of chaos because your leader decided not to come with you.
Yeah, that's a different
side. And you were sent off. You were going to be sent off to some remote hotel somewhere.
Right. Well, this is a little later now. Okay, so now I'm now on the beach or whatever. So we go to Jokjakarta. Yes, that's what Douglas Oliver had organized the thing. Clyde, as they say, was the real entrepreneur behind it all and set it all up. But Doug Oliver had gone to Jogja, it's a central Java, in Palestine, where there was the new national university had just been founded. It was founded in the Sultan's Palace. Beautiful time. It's a beautiful town and a beautiful place at that time. I still remember it with extraordinary nostalgia. I can really get nostalgic about it. But the thing is, yes, just, I can't think, it was more than a week or two before we left. Memory is not certain, but it wasn't long before we left that he suddenly said he had some sort of mysterious illness, and he wasn't going to go. And of course, he had made an arrangement. As I say, he had hardly told. He intimated a few of it, by and large, except that we were going to work with Gajamai, they were going to be students. It wasn't very clear what was going to go on. But there were three professors, nationalists. I mean, this is in the middle of the nationalist revolution, you know, who they're very, they're not trustful of foreigners. I mean, especially of, you know, I remember the first thing one of the professors said to me, I said something, he was asking, I was still a kid, and he said, what kind of your methodology? And I said, I'm essentially an empiricist. And he said, made some wisecrack about what's the difference between an empiricist and an imperialist. So we were off on a right foot, though later he became very nice. There were these three professors, quite different characters, and they were going to, it had been set up, there were going to be about 30 students from Gajah Mada, The university. Yeah. That's the name of the university. And of course, they were. This was all new, and they had no. You know, these students were not students. I mean, they were students, but they hadn't. They really knew nothing. They didn't claim to. I can't claim that. I mean, but they were going to learn from us. That was the idea. But we were going to have these 30 students. We were all going to go up and sit in a hotel, in a old sort of watering hole, because it's one of the few places in Java that doesn't grow rice. I mean, it's that high up. It's a rather beautiful place, and it's interesting in itself. But we were going to sit in this hotel, and the government officials were going to bring in people for us to interview in company with these students in a kind of mass interview situation. This is the way the Adat Law tradition people in Holland and way many Dutch anthropologists had worked. You know, they went and to a village. The village chief called in people, and they asked him questions about, you know, what do you call your brother? What do you call your cross cousin? What do you do? You know, how what happens at marriage and so on. And you wrote it all down and you published in books. Well, this was about as antithetical to everything we've been trained. Participant observation was what we've been trained to do. The anthropologist is sort of one of them, you know, right in the middle of it. The sort of lone, the Malinowskian image. It couldn't have been further from what we had in mind. And we simply weren't going to do this. I mean, very early on we thought this was ruinous. But in addition to that, of course, they suspected that Oliver's not coming was a plot of some sort, that he really had never attempted to keep his side of the bargain. And they were deeply suspicious. They said, what do you know, you may come out here with this full Harvard professor and you're going to do this marvelous thing, and you send us a bunch of graduate students. I was almost the oldest. No, Ed Ryan was the oldest, but they were good. So we did the best we could, this was 8 months of this, of our trying to get disentangled from that situation without a leader, without any status. And eventually they said Rufus Hennen was great, but Rufus also at that time was not a major figure. I mean, he was at least a faculty member, which is a little step up, but that he was a young, I think he may have been only an assistant professor or associate professor. Anyway, he was not a major figure. But he did very well, but he came later. And then finally, it finally did, I've written about how this all happened. Don Fagg, myself, Hilly, and Ed Ryan just got in. We had a car that was provided to us and just rode all over Eastern Java, East Central Java, trying to find a town that we could work in. We found one where there was a very fine local. The key to anthropology work is who's in charge locally, as you know. I mean, if you could, especially in a place like Indonesia, if the district officer, a man named Odono, if he wants you there and he's got, this guy was great. He was an old nationalist. He really thought this was a great idea, that Americans would understand it. I mean, he had it all right, and he understood we wanted to live with families. He set it up. So he was, that's what made us decide to go there. There were some others that were possible. Pare, this is Pare.
They thought another 2,000 or 3,000 of you were coming shortly.
No, that's just a rumor. I don't think most of them did. But I had some later when we talked yesterday. Some people said, I think there's going to be 1,000 of you. And I said, no, there's just 5 or 6 of us. And, you know, and then we were distributed around the area, and we worked there for 2 years, 2.5 years. And so it all worked out well. We detached ourselves. We didn't have the students. That ended. There was a lot of bitterness felt. And the bitterness, they had right to feel some bitterness. Here they had been deceived, and so, not purposely, at least not by me, but so we just worked there, and we got on good relationships eventually with these three professors, and one of them especially was very supportive. Another one was also sort of, so it all worked out in the end, but it was extremely, when Rufus came, he went to see the culture minister, an Islamic medical figure who was an intense nationalist, who subjected Rufus to about 3 hours of bitter harangue about what faithless Americans were like. But we had it coming in a way. I mean, we as a group, I didn't feel personally had it coming, but we as a group had it coming. And but then at the end he said, oh, essentially, fuck you, go ahead and do it. I mean, the Japanese version of that or whatever, go ahead. Don't bother me again. I don't want to hear of you. If anything happens to you, don't write me. And we went off, and it worked out beautifully. I mean, the years there were marvelous. And so it was the end. And then their relationship with Gajamata did smooth out. I mean, they became cordial. And I think, again, looking back at the professors and the whole apparatus there, were just as relieved themselves. They all had gotten in too deep, into something they didn't understand.
You've been back many times.
Oh, many times, yeah.
obviously, what is it about field work? I mean, do you do it because you know it's important to you, or do you do it because you enjoy it, or...?
I love it, yeah, I enjoy it. Well, it's important, too, but at least I hope it's important. No, I've never been happier than in the field. Not all the time, it's hell much of the time, but yeah, I liked it. Anthropologists lead a very oddly divided life. I guess part of it has a kind of self-proving thing. I would have not thought I was, when I taught, I'm going around circles, but when I taught later, you can't tell when you have students in class whether they're going to be good field workers or not. Some of the brightest can't do it. Some of the least impressive in class can, but it doesn't work that way either. I mean, there's just no correlation between classwork and fieldwork abilities. I mean, sometimes they go together, sometimes they're both bright in class and bright in the field, sometimes they're one or the other, but you cannot predict. I was never able to predict who would become good fielders, nor for myself. And I didn't think that I would be, but I found that I was good at it, I feel I was good at it. I mean, never mind what the world thinks, but I think that I was good at it. And I liked it. I worked. It's excruciating. It's a tremendous amount of effort and work. But I've always been happier in the field than anywhere else.
So you were, that time, I think it was, definitely one of the times, you were very, very ill.
Almost died, yeah.
Both of you very ill.
Different times, yeah, we both.
War going on around you.
Oh, that's later, yeah.
I mean, the conditions sound horrendous, and yet you still went back for more.
Oh, yeah. Well, it goes with the territory. I did go up for more. That was later on. I was sick even the first time I almost died. I had pneumonia and almost died. I stayed in the hospital in Jokja for several months. And then later, yes, that was a later trip. That was about 10 years further on. I was in the middle of a war, and I had tropical malaria, and also I couldn't see because they had given me
kind of myopia,
yeah, it was terrible. And Hilly was practically dying when she had hepatitis. Mm. It turned yellow, and we were isolated in this place, and there was no doctors except one German doctor who had been on the Italian front. But anyway, and we fled across, and so, and that story's all about, I've told that story in the...
Did you not think in the middle of all that, I'm never going to do any more field work?
Not a minute, no. As soon as we got back, and then we got back there, and Hilly recovered, and I recovered first, and then Hilly got more or less okay. They invaded us from the sky. We were in an oil camp belonging to American Oil Company. We went there because there was a hospital there, and she could be treated. Took a horrendous trip across the middle of Sumatra. And we got invaded by paratroopers, and then we went back to Bali and finished out. We didn't go home. We went back another 6-7 months to Bali. It interrupted a program I had. I was going to go to Sulawesi and so on, but that was not possible. And I was going to work in Nankabao, and that wasn't possible either. But no, and then I've been back, yes, as you said. And I worked, most of the work in Morocco came after that. so I've never thought about not going. I would like to go. No, the last time I was back was about 3 years ago. Mm. I was back for only then about 6 weeks or something. But I went all over the place, and yeah, I still like it. I would do it if I thought I would survive. I'm not so sure I would survive now.
What is it? Is it curiosity? Is it the relaxing of the relations that you have in your own study? Many anthropologists find a great sense of relief.
What it is finding out about how people are really quite different than you are, what they're all about. I find that an absolutely intriguing thing to do, to figure out what the hell is going on with these people, what the hell is happening here, how this works, how it. And the Javanese and the Balinese and the Moroccans are to me endlessly intriguing. I mean, it's the kind of, I have a reputation of not being a very scientifically oriented, probably I'm not a hard scientist type. But in that regard, I am. I really am very, I want to know what this. So I have the same kind of puzzlement that, that a physicist would have about why some phenomena go about stars or something. I mean, I want to understand them. My main motives are radically cognitive. I wouldn't put it that way because I don't like the idea of cognitive even that way, but they are to interpret and understand these. And I enjoy that. I enjoy just figuring them out and figuring out how to get along with them and figuring out how to live with them and figuring out what makes them tick. I just find that extraordinary. And And being allowed to do it without anybody telling me how to do it. That's the other thing you do have in the field. You're your own person, and you can do what you want. I mean, there are constraints, so millions of constraints, but they're not the constraints of professors and courses. And so I just find it endlessly fascinating. I find the Javanese and the Balinese and the Moroccans, the three groups I worked with, endlessly. I could spend the rest of my life just trying to figure out what the hell they're all about.
Was that, I mean, you started in philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
So were there any larger questions? I mean, the earlier generations of anthropologists were trying to find out whether there was a common humanity or, you know, very general questions about human nature and human progress and so on. Behind the curiosity of trying to find out what they were about and understanding them, were there some more general questions?
Well, you see, in the first lecture I'm about to give, I come to talk about meaning a bit, but I really... Yes, I was asked general questions about how people construct meaningful lives, but I, again, I'm a fox, not a hedgehog, so I don't think that there's a single kind of underlying. I've always been opposed. I've always been pluralist. I assume people really are different. I mean, not radically different. If they wouldn't, they couldn't talk to each other. This is, I don't want to get the relativism arguments, but I think people, I do really think Javanese are not just a different version of Americans. I mean, I think they're very profoundly themselves, or Moroccans or Balinese. So I'm not looking for common humanity in that sense. Sure, there's common humanity. We're all human beings. But I'm looking for the specific, particular expressions of it. Again, I start off in literature. I'm interested in specific expressions. I'm interested in the, you know, when you study literature, you're not interested, well, at least the way I study it, you're not interested in some sort of general notion of what literature is. You're interested in, you know, Dickens and Shakespeare and Emily Dickinson and in my case, and Hawthorne and people. What is specific and special and extraordinary about these people? So I'm more like that. So I'm not looking for some sort of abstract common humanity. I'm not denying people are human, and that's certainly true. But I'm more interested in the Javanese, of the Javaneseness of the Javanese and the Moroccanness of the Moroccan and the Americanness of myself. That's what concerns me, and I'm trying to puzzle it out. I'm interested in people's ways of being in the world, is the Heideggerian phrase, which, you know, I think is the right way to put it. I mean, I think that's what, or form of life in Wittgenstein's sense, I'm interested in exactly. And I'm interested in those in the way in which anyone interested in diversity, the way Darwin was interested in species or animals, about what they are really like. Now, it doesn't mean you don't want some general notions. I do. I've tried to make some general arguments. But I'm not an Enlightenment figure that's trying to figure out what people are like underneath it all. I want to find out what they're like within it all. I don't know if that makes any sense, but
that's... It does. We'll come back to it, but just one last question along those lines. I mean, I think Edmund Leach and also Keith Thomas have both said that the only point of history or anthropology in those two cases is really as a mirror of your own society. In other words, it will tell you something about your own world and make you better in your own world. Not taking it to that extreme, did you ever feel that this might also help you to understand America?
Oh, it certainly helps you to understand yourself and America. I don't agree with that position, however. That's exactly what we're not supposed to be doing. I'm not studying Javanese in the service of understanding the United States. I'm studying the Javanese to understand the Javanese. So I don't agree with... Keith is a great friend of mine, but I don't agree with that. Wait, Keith Hopkins or Keith Thomas? We'll get mixed
together.
Keith Thomas, yeah. So I don't, I mean, I think it does, but I think we do really want to understand the other as the other, not as just a pale reflection of us or as a way of into our own selves. I think that's more narcissistic than I care to be, which doesn't mean you don't learn anything about the United States by being abroad. Of course you do, and it's changed my views of all kinds of things. But I went to Java and Morocco and Bali to understand Java and Morocco and Bali. Not to understand the United States.